Background to Ezra Nehemiah in chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 3, verse 7. Prologue, part 1. The first talk in a series on Ezra Nehemiah was presented by Gil Greco on July 26, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gil Greco. This recording is being made available to you by Gutenberg College, a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was taken from a talk originally streamed online. Handout number 1, Ezra chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 4, verse 5, accompanies this talk.
Welcome to Online Reformation Fellowship. I'm Gil Greco. In case you don't know me, I am a Gutenberg graduate, graduated in 2012. Erin Julian was what her name was before she married me, and we moved to Kansas City, and I started teaching at a classical school out there. I went to Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary to try to get a Master of Arts in Biblical Languages. Unfortunately, the way that I took my courses, I didn't actually get to the Biblical Languages. And then we moved back here for us to be the house managers for Gutenberg College. So I'm going to be teaching for the next little bit. I'm going to be teaching Ezra Nehemiah. And my plan today is to talk about some introductory matters with regard to Ezra Nehemiah. And then we will get into the text. There is a link for a handout that I produced for this. I have formatted the text of Ezra Nehemiah from basically the New American Standard. I have changed a couple of words. I have put in a couple of edits for ways that I think things should be translated. And I may have changed those since I made that available. And let's get started. So the first question that I want to talk about is why read, why study, why am I teaching Ezra Nehemiah? I started studying Ezra Nehemiah with David a little while ago. I was interested in studying Ezra Nehemiah because Ezra Nehemiah is potential background for the prophetic book of Malachi. Malachi, I was interested in because I had studied it while I was at Midwestern Baptist. And Malachi is very hard. It probably can't be dated with any kind of certainty. But scholars have identified a couple of different points in Ezra Nehemiah that could be sort of the spot for Malachi to take place. But while David and I were studying Ezra Nehemiah, I realized that Ezra Nehemiah is very worthwhile on its own. In our last section, when we were studying Daniel with David, David was talking about how Daniel, like every book of the Bible, is a look at the gospel. And I think that Ezra Nehemiah is no exception to that idea. The gospel, I think, in the way that David is talking about, is a much broader sort of concept than just the story of Jesus's passion and resurrection. It sort of encompasses everything that God is doing with mankind throughout history. And I think David initially agreed to study an Ezra Nehemiah with me because he's interested in what is called cultural literacy, or what he's called Hebrew cultural literacy. And that's the idea that when the original audience of the Old Testament was coming to these texts, they had a certain background that they brought with them that informed what it was they understood from those texts. And Ezra Nehemiah is, like most historical books in the Old Testament and most of the Old Testament in general, helps us to understand that Hebrew cultural literacy. So I'm interested in Ezra Nehemiah because I'm interested in the gospel. I'm interested in Ezra Nehemiah because I'm interested in understanding Hebrew cultural literacy. And then David told me when we finished studying Ezra Nehemiah that I needed to try to teach it. So here I am. Okay, so that's why I'm teaching Ezra Nehemiah. You'll notice that in my handout that I have hyphenated Ezra Nehemiah. And that is because Ezra Nehemiah is a single book. The history supports the idea that Ezra Nehemiah is a single book. The Masoretes, who were the compilers of the Hebrew text that we have now, they would keep statistics of all kinds of things for each book of the Old Testament. And one of the things they would do is they would keep the numbers of words, and they would keep counts of what the first word or the last word or the word right in the middle of the book was. And all of those statistics point to Ezra Nehemiah being a single book. The word counts don't work unless you add Ezra and Nehemiah together. The middle word only works if you have Ezra and Nehemiah smashed together because it's in the first chapter of Nehemiah. And apparently Ezra and Nehemiah did not get separated books in regular Bibles until Latin Bibles started doing it in somewhere around the 9th century. There's a little more to say about that story if anyone's interested, but we'll only talk about that if you're interested in the question sections at the end. I also think that it is important to think of Ezra and Nehemiah as a single book thematically. I am going to be speaking to a very sort of large, broad brushstroke structure to Ezra and Nehemiah. And that structure can basically be broken down into five elements. So the structure of Nehemiah goes A, B, and then C. So you have two parts that are very similar. Basically, one is at the beginning of Ezra. Basically, one is at the beginning of the Nehemiah section. And then there's a B section in both of those. And then Nehemiah closes with a third element that doesn't have a corresponding piece in the section that we would think of as Ezra. So I've written basically what to expect in each of these sections. So the A part, or the A element, recounts history like this. There is a good king, or at least a king who is interested in the good of Israel, who allows the Israelites to take part in some building project. In Ezra, that's the temple. In Nehemiah, it's the walls of Jerusalem. And the project is completed despite opposition. Then there's the B element. The B element, what happens in that section is, despite Israel's political success through whatever the building project is, it becomes clear that there's a more fundamental problem to which a true-hearted Israelite responds. So in Ezra's section, the true-hearted Israelite is Ezra. In the Nehemiah section, that's Nehemiah or Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah are both in Nehemiah in that section. So it depends on kind of how you want to look at it. And then finally, the element that's not in Ezra that is in Nehemiah, Nehemiah leaves, goes back to Persia. He is the cupbearer to the king of Persia. He is with the king of Persia for some indefinite amount of time. He comes back and finds that all of the reforms that he had enacted have been reversed, and that everything is worse than it was before he left, or before he got there and sort of fixed things. So he enacts many reforms, but ends only with the hope that all his efforts will cause Yahweh to remember him. So we're going to see that despite God sort of taking care of the people of Israel, allowing them political success in finishing various building projects, despite allowing them success, despite whatever opposition they have, the people are still rebellious. And we are sort of confronted at the end by a true-hearted individual hoping that God will remember him despite what's going on in his nation. So that's sort of the big structure, and I will return to that again and again as I try to go through Ezra and Nehemiah, show you how that's what's going on. Okay, who wrote Ezra and Nehemiah? Tradition tells us that Ezra wrote it. There is a trend in the 20th century scholarship to believe that Ezra Nehemiah is the product of what they call the chronicler, and this is the author who is unnamed who wrote 1st and 2nd Chronicles. I think it's clear that the work has a specific purpose, that Ezra Nehemiah has a specific purpose, and it is pieced together from many different sources, but with a singular vision. So this could have been Ezra, it could have been Nehemiah. Barring some kind of major archaeological discovery that says, and the guy who wrote Ezra Nehemiah was this guy, I'm not sure that we can be sure exactly which of those folks was responsible. As we go through the text, I will be talking about the various sources that piece this work together. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. I just want to note at the outset, before we go forward, I want to note my limitations as a teacher and things that I hope you will be remembering as I go forward, because some of the way that I think about things is biased because of these limitations. So the first thing is, I feel very keenly that there is a certain standard of teaching at Reformation Fellowship, which is why the folks who are a part of this community continue to be a part of this community. In many ways, preparing for this is intimidating. I feel a lot of pressure to put together something that meets that standard of quality. I hope that this has produced and will continue to produce an excellent in the work that I'm doing, and that what I have to say is helpful, clear, and clarifying of the text that we're studying. But I ask you guys, again, to help me with your questions and comments at the end. My second limitation is that I don't know Hebrew. I can read phonetically with a lot of work. I did start taking sort of elementary Hebrew at Midwestern, but it's not even enough Hebrew to know when commentators are making credible arguments about Hebrew. I know Greek well enough to know when people are saying things about verbs that don't make any sense, but I don't know that about Hebrew. So I'm largely dependent on English texts and what commentaries say about particular words or phrases or other things of that sort. So that may be something that is keeping me from recognizing things about the text. My third limitation is that history is very hard for me. When I was taking my 2 years at Gutenberg College, they have exams that are oral exams where they sort of look at your sort of general knowledge of Western civilization. And I was told that I understand kind of how ideas affect each other and how why people would respond to one idea with another idea, but I have a very hard time sort of understanding history. So it's very hard for me to sort of understand why, for instance, economics would cause a war to happen. I generally have a hard time sort of thinking of all of those pieces. So while I hope that I have more skill at understanding history than I did 10 years ago, which is when I took my 2 years at Gutenberg, it's still some of the hardest stuff for me to think about well. So keep that in mind as I'm working through here. If there's something that doesn't occur to me because I'm not thinking about history in the right way, then be sure to comment or ask a question. So I would like to talk now about the background to Ezra Nehemiah. In some ways, it's serendipitous that David just finished Daniel, since he is much more knowledgeable in history than I am, and apparently Ezra Nehemiah is happening just around the same time as the end of Daniel. I didn't know, for instance, that Darius the Mede was Cyrus the Great. I knew that there was some question about who Darius the Mede was, and when I was doing research to teach this, I looked at the few books that I have that are sort of background to Old Testament, things like that. Apparently, I had a book that said that Darius the Mede was Cyrus, but I didn't remember that I had that book or that I had read that at some point. So, even though David has just done Daniel, which was looking at a lot of the history, and despite the limitations I have in understanding history, I would like to briefly review the whole history of Israel as we're heading into Ezra and Nehemiah. So the beginning of the story really starts with Genesis, with creation, and we start with the story of man. Man is simultaneously the pinnacle of God's creation. Creation is, in some sense, about ending with man. And at the same time, man turns out to be extremely rebellious. He is so rebellious, in fact, that God decides that he is sorry that he has made man and decides that he is going to destroy everyone in the world except for Noah and his family, who are the only people who survive the flood that God sends to punish the world. So God sends this flood. Everyone except Noah dies. After Noah emerges from the ark, God tells Noah that God is going to be stepping back from history. He's no longer going to be sort of intervening. We see God sort of speaking directly to Cain, for instance. But God is now going to be much more in the background, and the person, the people, or the institution that is going to enforce God's laws are going to be states. I think it says if a man murders someone by his, I don't have the quotation. His blood will be shed by man, right? So now men will be the adjudicators of God's justice rather than God sort of directly visiting his wrath and his discussion to man sort of directly. So we begin a new age, as it were, and this new age has the state as a serious component of how the world operates. We see then that man begins to really value the state. We ultimately see that in Babel. And Babel is sort of this pinnacle sort of state, what David kept referring to as empire when he was talking through Daniel. So we see that Babel is this empire. It's the beginning of an empire, and it's the pinnacle of human creation. But at the same time, it is rebellious, just as man is rebellious. So God scatters Babel. He scatters the Babylonians, the people who are making Babel, and he scatters them about the earth, and they are not successful in sort of having this ultimate state that can compete with God in some way. So God then decides that the way that he's going to deal with humanity is by hunting for and recreating the hearts of individuals. And he does this by picking just some random guy in Mesopotamia, whose name is Abram, to be the father of a great nation. He blesses Abraham in several ways. He materially blesses Abraham with flocks and with land, and he's just very successful everywhere he goes. And these material blessings are signs of a more important blessing. And the reason why God is conferring this blessing on Abraham is because Abraham is faithful. Abraham has faith. And God is in the process of working on Abraham so that he has a kind of faith that God is going to bless. The great nation that Abraham is going to eventually be the father of is eventually the Israelites. In the time of Joseph, there is a famine and they all go down to Egypt. And eventually they are enslaved in Egypt, and all of the apparent material blessings that had been attending Abraham and his family up to that point are taken from them, and they are enslaved. And so God, in the process of history, he raises up Moses. Moses begins the project of making Israel a great nation. He begins the project of making Israel a kingdom of priests. It's been very helpful in my thinking about this. I was talking to Sam Hobbs about the way in which God works in history. And he came up with this metaphor that I think is very helpful to talk about. God sometimes works with the grain of history, and sometimes he works against the grain of history. So the Exodus, which is where Moses is, the conduit for what God is doing to free the Israelites and to show the world what he is about. That is one of the great instances in the story of history recorded in the Bible where God is working against the grain of history. It is very obvious that God is active. It is very obvious that he is interested in people knowing that he is God and that he is working out his purposes in history. God uses a series of plagues to bring the people of Israel out of Egypt and takes them into the wilderness. Eventually they are cornered against the Red Sea. By the Egyptians, God opens the sea, they walk through, and then he destroys the Egyptians by letting the water crash back in. So miraculous time, the plagues are miraculous, opening the Red Sea is miraculous. It is very overt, it is very obvious that God is doing something special at the time of the Exodus. The people of Israel make their way to Mount Sinai, and Mount Sinai, they're given the covenant. As Moses is receiving the covenant, the people rebel, they show themselves to be rebellious, and they make a golden calf. God is outraged. There is a division created between people of Israel and God. And Moses, after being very angry at them for screwing this up so royally, he intervenes on their behalf and tries to completely restore the relationship between Israel and God. This results finally in building the tabernacle, which is where God's presence is, And this is commemorated at the end of Exodus by the celebration of Sukkot, which is, we sometimes call it the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booths. And the idea is that God is in his tent and all the people are in their little tents and they're all tenting together. God is among them. At the end of his life, Moses recognizes from the ample evidence he's had of the rebellion of the people, on their way to the promised land, they are rebellious and they are prevented from entering, at least a generation is prevented from entering the promised land for 40 years. He recognizes from all this experience that it's going to take a miracle for the kingdom of priests not to be rebellious. So even this special nation that has been set aside for this special purpose in history, even it is rebellious, and it will take something special from God in order for them to be able to realize the destiny of being this people. One final thing that I would like to note here that is not so relevant to Ezra and Nehemiah, but is relevant to the rest of the history we're going to talk about, is that Moses talks about what is important in the role of a good king. And the role of the good king is to be, to copy out by hand the whole law. So in some ways, the king of Israel is more of the judiciary, if we were going to sort of use those terms to think about Israel. It's a little bit anachronistic, but they're more of the judiciary than they are the executive. They are supposed to be the leading expert on what the law is about, and they are supposed to understand its content. They are supposed to understand the author behind the content. They are supposed to understand God behind the content. And then the idea is that they would direct the people to live in conformity with that law. What kings in the ancient Near East tended to be was conquerors. They tended to multiply horses and have chariots and go out to war and conquer things and marry a lot of wives to sort of cement relationships between different parties. And you can see that the state, which had been created as this sort of way to deal with man's evil, it sort of turns into this thing that has a sort of a life of its own and a rebellious life of its own. And so the king of Israel is supposed to run a state that is not interested in doing what most states do, but is interested in loving and doing the will of God by understanding the law. So Moses dies, and he is replaced by Joshua. Joshua, with the people of God, move into the land that God had promised to Abraham, and they establish the people in the land, ensuring physical blessings. Now, there is a lot of complex history in terms of whether Joshua did everything they were supposed to do and whether they got rid of all of the folks that they were supposed to. But for a moment, the people are living in their cities as they were supposed to. And at least on the outside, it appears that they have these physical blessings. However, becomes apparent as we move into the time of the judges that in those days, there was no king in Israel. And everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, for the longest time, I took that phrase to just mean everybody did what they wanted to, because there was no king to sort of punish people, which in some sense is true. However, if we remember that Moses' instructions about the good king was that he would explain the law to his people, then it is interesting to note that because there's no king in Israel, everyone does what they think is right in their own eyes. So God raises up judges, not kings, and their role is to free the people from the various opponents that come in and try to take the physical blessings from them. It is apparent throughout the judges that the judges are not necessarily interested in fostering the sort of inner or the true blessing that had been promised to Abraham, and that the outward blessings were signs for Abraham. They are just there to get rid of the bad guys in one generation to the next, so that the people can sort of live in their land relatively undisturbed, at least for the time that the judge is working. But as you go through judges, you see that those judges are progressively more and more lawless. So this finally comes to an end, and I'm going to skip Saul because the history of Saul and David is very complicated. So I'm just going to say that David finally comes, and he is sort of the true king of Israel. The way that the Bible looks at David is that he is actually completing this role of being the kind of king that Moses had instructed the people of Israel to have. Now, he is also a man of war, so it's complicated because he does marry a bunch of women, he does fight a bunch of wars, but he is a man after God's own heart, and he is the kind of king who is interested in the law. I want to just talk about one story from the life of David that sort of illustrates this. It is often confusing to a lot of people why the one guy who puts the Ark of the Covenant on the cart and reaches out and touches it and dies, why this happens. And I think a lot of it has to do with our sort of experience of American culture, American Christian culture, in that there's always some guy, even if he's a crazy person, sort of on the street block, at least quoting, you know, John 3:16 or, you know, saying things that are from Revelation or whatever. And so we've always had sort of a presence in our short history, somebody reminding us that the Bible is sort of an important thing. But the way that the story is told in Chronicles, it seems as if we need to remember that before David, that phrase from Judges continuously applies. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Well, how do you bring the Ark of the Covenant up to Jerusalem? Well, if you don't have anyone studying the law, then the right way is to put it on a cart and carry it up. And the fact that the guy who reaches out and touches the ark dies is sort of this crisis where David goes back to the scripture and figures out what it is, how is it that we're supposed to do this? And in doing that, he actually finds that the Levites are supposed to act in a certain way. The priests are supposed to act in a certain way. They are farming at the time that David is looking at things, and he has to re-find all of this information for how the Levites and the priests are supposed to conduct themselves as they go about moving the Ark of the Covenant. Furthermore, the law is not comprehensive. That is, the law doesn't cover every single case that you could possibly encounter. David has done a wonderful job in his talks on Exodus and in his talks on Numbers, showing how even as the law is being given, there are these little innovations that get made that God honors or that God doesn't honor, depending on whether they have understood what God is up to, whether they have interpreted sort of the spirit of the law correctly or not. And one of the innovations that David makes is that he decides that he needs to put together a temple, a permanent residence for God, rather than a tabernacle. It is David's idea that this needs to happen. The fact that the tabernacle is no longer going to be mobile and that they're going to have a permanent sort of settled spot for the temple means that the Levites, who are sort of the grunt workers of the tribe of Levi, they're responsible for sort of cutting wood and in some cases killing animals and sort of bringing things so that the priests can sort of do the things that they need to do. And one of the things they did was moving the tabernacle or moving pieces of the tabernacle according to which family they were a part of. They got different things. You know, they got the covering or the poles or whatever. So they're no longer going to be needed to do that. So David commissions them to be prophets with musical instruments. And so he sets up a system whereby the Levites, who no longer have to carry the tabernacle, serve a particular kind of function in the temple. And this is going to be important as we get into Ezra and Nehemiah, because they are going to look at the things that David set up as part of how they do things. One final story from the life of David, and then we'll move on to sort of more obviously relevant things to Ezra and Nehemiah. One of the things that shows, one of the innovations that David makes that shows that he is the kind of king that God is interested in rather than the kind of king that everyone else is there is this episode where they have gotten the priests consecrated. They set up the Ark of the Covenant with the poles. They're carrying it up to where it's going to sit until the temple is built. David is not allowed to build the temple in his lifetime. And they're carrying it up to where it's going to sit. And he is dancing in front of the Ark, wearing a linen ephod. And his wife, Michal, scorns him. Now, most people, when they look at that story, think that the reason why she scorns him is because he's dancing. That's never made much sense to me. The reason why she scorns him is because he's wearing a linen ephod. Linen ephods are what priests wear. Linen ephods show that you are subservient to God. And in wearing a linen ephod, he is not setting himself apart as the king. He is just a servant in the same way that the priests are servants. And if you remember, Michael's father is Saul, and Saul was, you know, the thing about him was that he was tall and kingly, and David was not that kind of person. So David is more interested in understanding how he should relate himself to God, as a servant, rather than in being sort of recognized as this sort of special king that his wife would sort of see as respectable, sort of the sort of state leader that we've expected from kings. So David is prohibited from building the temple, but his son, David goes ahead and buys all of the supplies to build the temple. He just gets it ready. He can't build it himself, but this is a project that he's wanted to do his whole life, and he knows that his son Solomon will follow through. Solomon is an intensely, extremely shrewd king, but he does not, at least at the beginning of his life, at least while he's ruling, does not share David's heart for God. And so immediately after the episode, the very famous story where Solomon gains wisdom, he begins amassing horses, which is one of the things that Moses had said not to do. Solomon is a very good politician. He builds the first temple, and he amasses huge wealth for Israel. Unfortunately, after him and in his lifetime, his sons there is a civil war, basically. And the kingdom is split after Solomon into the northern and southern kingdoms. So after some time, of Israel, which is generally what the northern kingdom is called, and Judah, which is the southern kingdom, sort of doing their own thing. Eventually, the first empire sort of rear its head on in the stage of world history, sort of after Babel. Assyria shows up, and eventually it conquers Israel. It conquers Samaria, which is the capital of the northern kingdom, in 722 BC. Assyria had a policy of clearing out a tract of land that they had conquered. And then they would take a bunch of different people from a bunch of different groups and take all those people and place them in that land. So you wouldn't have a bunch of Israelites living together. You would have a bunch of people from different places. And the idea was that if you could separate ethnic and cultural groups, then they would not have enough in common to be able to come together and form any kind of threat to the Assyrian Empire. The downside to that strategy is when the only thing that unites everybody in a given geographical area is their hatred of the empire that put them there, then if they ever fight against that empire is going to have a lot of trouble on its hands. While Assyria is sort of in the background doing what it's doing and moving people around, in their domains, there are a series of prophets, Isaiah is one of them, who warn the kings of Israel against being swayed by the apparent strength of empire. There is a temptation in the fear of Assyria of going to Egypt and depending on Egypt rather than on God to protect you from Assyria. And the prophets warn not to do that. Do not be so concerned with your political well-being, with your sort of worldly, the outward signs of your blessing and prosperity, that you surrender the ultimate blessing, right? What does it profit man to gain the alliance of a worldly power if you lose your soul? These worldly concerns also foster a sort of a destructive apathy to the people who are most vulnerable in society. And so you see the prophets constantly raging against the people who are ignoring orphans and widows, because what can orphans and widows do to protect me from the Assyrians? I need to make sure that I'm okay, and if the orphans and widows are hurt by that, well, we've got bigger fish to fry. The track record for the kings of Israel, the kings of the northern kingdom, is not any good. All of them are terrible. And only a handful of the kings in the southern kingdom remember God or honor God in any way. Now, one of the kings that does honor God, although he does have a complicated life, is King Hezekiah. And because of the way that he interacts with God, Isaiah prophesies that Assyria will not overrun Hezekiah while he is still king. So Hezekiah is sort of happy about that. And we do see in the biblical text and in other sources that are extra biblical or not part of the Bible, that Sennacherib, who is sort of the emperor at one point in the Assyrian Empire, attacks Jerusalem, but is unable to conquer it. But the prophets tell us that when Israel and when Jerusalem and when Judah finally do fall, it will not be because of the empires, it will be because God is still working out his purposes in history. Empires don't have anything on God. If Israel falls, it's God's doing. Ultimately, and one of the most important things for what we're looking at in Ezra and Nehemiah, is that God has picked Cyrus, who is sort of the first Persian emperor, to bring about his purposes. So even if Israel is conquered, that's God's doing. And if God restores Israel by using a emperor from a different country, that is still God's doing. There's a second empire called Babylon. It has a similar strategy to Assyria in putting isolated sort of ethnic and groups together that are isolated from their regular cultures. But again, they hate Babylon so much that when they finally do rebel, it is problematic. Nebuchadnezzar removes the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem in 605 BC, and then eventually he destroys the temple in Jerusalem, and he sacks Jerusalem, and that's sometime in the 590s or 580s, something like that. I told you I didn't know history. So Nebuchadnezzar is successful in finally sacking Jerusalem. But as we saw in Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar is referred to as a lion who is given the heart of a man. So even though he is extremely destructive in sort of his progress, God is not only working through empires, but he is even changing the hearts of emperors. So then finally, one of Nebuchadnezzar's descendants, Belshazzar, is defeated by Cyrus, who is the leader of Persia. And Persia as an empire has a much more lenient policy in general than the other two empires that we have seen. And I will talk about that as we get into the text. The text is going to sort of deal directly with that. Okay, so I think we're about ready to get into the text. I want to just make a couple observations about this handout that I've made. There is a lot of scholarly, what's called textual critical work on Ezra. Textual critical work, what it's attempting to do is it's attempting to look at a passage of scripture and say, where did this come from? You know, what tradition or what person or what source did this come from, and how is it sort of put together with other things? In general, I think this is sort of an illegitimate enterprise, that people will sort of look at the fact that in Genesis or in the Pentateuch in general, for instance, you have God being called Elohim in one passage and Yahweh in another passage, and so they couldn't be written by the same person because it's a different name of God. So I am suspicious of a lot of textual critical work. However, it's more understandable in Ezra Nehemiah, because in Ezra Nehemiah, the text itself says, here is a copy of letter X that was written by so-and-so. Okay, so what I have tried to do in this handout is I have tried to use formatting and font and style to try to clue in that there's a different sort of thing, a different source or something like that going on. And I think the tech, and in general, when I make those kinds of decisions, it has to do with what the text is actually just telling me in the very words of what it's saying. There are places in the commentaries where people will make comments like, well, this obviously was dependent on an official document, because otherwise how could he have known the name of the official? And so they would expect you to sort of, it's almost like Ezra was writing and he's like, well, I don't know what the name of that guy is. So they put it like a blank, and then he came back to it once he had found the document that told him that name and then wrote it in. I have not done that. That would require me to sort of underline a bunch of names, and that seems silly. And I don't understand why he couldn't have just known what the guy's name was. So, all right. So let's get into the actual text of Ezra Nehemiah. So Ezra Nehemiah begins with Ezra, and it is largely about Ezra. He is a priest, and then Nehemiah is largely about Nehemiah. Now, I will caveat that by saying the first six chapters of Ezra is focused on the return to Jerusalem and the building of the second temple, which is 60 years before Ezra even shows up. So we're going to meet an entire cast of people who are not Ezra before he's introduced in chapter 7. So about half, well, a little bit more than half of Ezra is taken up with people who aren't Ezra, and then sort of some major events happen where Ezra is involved. So that's why it's generally called Ezra, and we'll be reading that portion of the book. Now you can see if you have this handout that I have provided, that I have done something very similar to what Jack has done in the past, for instance, with his formatting of things. I have made things into paragraphs and then given you the verse in brackets down below that, if you're looking at it. So I will be referring to the paragraphs that I'm working on rather than the verses. I may refer to the verses sort of out of habit, but here we go. So paragraph 1 of Ezra. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all of his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of Yahweh, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Every survivor at whatever place he may live, let the men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem." Okay. So the first year of Cyrus is roughly 538 BC. We note that in this first section that Cyrus, in that first year, is fulfilling the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah. I want to read to you sort of the two verses that are sort of an encapsulation of what Jeremiah had said. The prophecy is taken from Jeremiah 25:12 and Jeremiah 29:10. The first one goes like this. "Then it will be, when 70 years are completed, I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, declares the Lord, for their iniquity and the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it an everlasting desolation." The second prophecy from Jeremiah 29:10. "For thus says the Lord, when 70 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you and fulfill my good word to you to bring you back to this place." So there is a prophecy that Jeremiah makes that 70 years after whatever is going on, right after they are completed, and the question is, where do you start the 70 years? I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, etc. We will see in a minute when we get to paragraph 3 that one of the options on the table is the removal of the vessels from the temple, and the return of those vessels to the temple is about a period of 70 years. So, Yahweh stirs up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, and he sends a proclamation to his whole kingdom. Now, Josephus tells us that Cyrus was aware of the prophecies in Isaiah about him. And especially given what David was talking about in the book of Daniel, if Daniel was in fact one of Cyrus's counselors, then Daniel could very well have given Cyrus access to the book of Isaiah. However, Cyrus in general had a much more lenient policy, or much more it was in Persia's interest to present themselves as saviors. If they would allow the peoples of the different lands to go back to their sort of historic homeland, practice their historic religions, then those people would be much less resentful of their rulers, and they would not try to rebel, And they, sure, they would have to pay tribute, but it would not be as big of a deal as being separated from everyone they loved and doing, you know, the religions that they were a part of. So Cyrus has a general policy that is much more lenient than the Assyrians. Now, you'll notice in how I have composed this thing on the handout. If you're looking at the handout, I have sort of the main text of 1-1 in Georgia, and then I go to, I think it's Garamond for the proclamation. Notice that it says, and also put it in writing, in parentheses. So my assumption is this section in of what is proclaimed, what the text there, is substantively what sort of your town crier would have gone around and said to all the Hebrews. Probably said it in Hebrew, and maybe he didn't say this exact thing each time, but this is basically the sort of thing that he would have said. And the editor, Ezra, lets us know that that's the case because he says he also put it in writing. So there's a sort of memorized proclamation that people are going out and saying, but there's also a version in writing, which we will read the text of later in Ezra Nehemiah. So Cyrus knows the name of the Israelites' God. He refers to him as Yahweh. This is one of the edits that I have made in my formatting of this document. In most sort of regular Bibles, the name of God will be sort of small caps, Lord, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, in small caps, but that's representing in Hebrew this name Yahweh. So I have just changed the text to reflect Yahweh every time that it is that in the text. The other times that it says God, that it's probably Elohim or El, which is just sort of the generic ancient Near East word for God. So more of a functional sort of thing than the personal thing. So he says, Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. So now we know from Daniel that... from the episode in Daniel in the Lion's Den, that Darius the Mede, who is Cyrus, recognizes Yahweh for being a special sort of, you know, he is the special God of heaven. There is some question whether he is actually sort of repentant, whether he is actually becoming a monotheist. Or whether he's just recognizing that Yahweh is special among gods. But this is, remember, this is in the first year of Cyrus. And I don't believe, if I have the chronology correct, that has yet happened in the life of Cyrus and the life of Daniel. So there's nothing in this proclamation that necessarily makes me believe that Cyrus is doing this out of actual devotion, special devotion to Yahweh. It is just part of the Persian policy to let everybody go back to their historical home and do their, you know, their historical religion. So I'm sure that there was a proclamation he sent out to, you know, the Elamites, and he said, Marduk, you know, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms in the earth. I am confident that that was the case. Now, again, I don't know. It could be that eventually in Cyrus's life that he recognized Yahweh as the one true God, but there's nothing in this proclamation that makes me think that. Okay, paragraph 2. Then the heads of fathers' households of Judah and Benjamin, the priests and the Levites arose, even everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up and rebuild the house of Yahweh, which is in Jerusalem. All those about them encouraged them with articles of silver, with gold, with goods, with cattle, and with valuables, aside from all that was given as a freewill offering. Okay, so it is crystal clear to the author in both this paragraph and the preceding paragraph that it is Yahweh, or God, who is stirring up the people to do what's happening. As we saw from our brief review of what was happening in the prophets, one of the things the prophets were adamant about was that whatever happens in history, God is the one doing it in history. So even though Cyrus has this sort of general policy of toleration that is allowing a bunch of people to go and do what they're doing, the author of Ezra is convinced that it is God who is moving Cyrus to do what he's doing. Similarly, you may have had people from Judah and Benjamin who are just interested in going back to their historic, you know, their historic farms and getting some, you know, doing economic activity and farming and making some money and whatever, and maybe they had more opportunity there than here, but it is still God who is responsible for moving them. It says, all those about them encouraged them with articles of silver, with gold, with goods, with cattle, and with valuables, aside from all that was given as a freewill offering. Now, I am convinced that the author of Ezra is interested in us comparing this event, the event of Ezra 1 through 6, this recounting of this first generation that goes back to Israel, is interested in us comparing this event to the Exodus. One of the things that happened in the Exodus was the famous, what we generally refer to as the plundering of the Egyptians. I have in my notes, okay, so in Exodus, we read, now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have the request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. Now here, it doesn't seem, there isn't a note that they're being plundered, and beyond silver and gold, they're given cattle and goods and valuables. And so in some ways, God is being more generous to the Israelites as they're heading out of Babylon or as they're heading out of Persia than he had been when the folks were moving out of Egypt. I will have some comments to make about that at the end. Paragraph 3. Also King Cyrus brought out the articles of the house of Yahweh, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and put in the house of his God. And Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought out by the hand of Mithridath, the treasurer, and he counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. Now this was their number, 30 gold dishes, 1,000 silver dishes, 29 duplicates, 30 gold bowls, 410 silver bowls of the second kind, and 1,000 other articles. All the articles of gold and silver numbered 5,400. Sheshbazzar brought them all up with the exiles when they went up from Babylon to Jerusalem. So this is evidence that the way that we are supposed to count the 70 years from the mouth of Jeremiah is from Nebuchadnezzar taking the temple vessels, which is roughly 605, and it's roughly 538 all this is happening. We are not told exactly when Sheshbazzar arrives in Israel, and we know that it's a little bit of a trip. It's not necessarily a three-year trip, but this is one of the things that David pointed to as the fact that that's how we should do the counting. So it's roughly 70 years. Speaking of roughly, if you do the math of these 30 gold dishes, 1,000 silver dishes, etc., it does not add up to 5,400, which is the total. David in the past has talked a lot about the big numbers in the Bible and how they add up, even within the text itself. it seems to me, I am confident the more that I watch, which I haven't been watching for long, but I watch David and he's been watching for a long time. The more that we learn about the ancient Near East, the more the scriptures are validated. So I am confident that something has happened. David has suggested that people have forgotten how to read numbers. In Hebrew, the way that numbers are communicated is through letters. So people have forgotten how to read things. It is worth noting, my assumption, I have put this in a different font, is that this is some kind of receipt. And possibly Mithridath had his name, released by Mithridath and received by Sheshbazar, and then they have their seals or whatever on that document. My assumption is whatever the document originally said, that it was accurate, and that somehow either through us forgetting or through the complications of having a Assyrian or a Persian document written in Aramaic being translated into Hebrew, and hundreds of years of copying this, that if we had the original text, that would be accurate. Furthermore, I just want to say 605 to 538 is not quite 70 years. It's just short of 70 years. And I am not a scholar who loves counting things. There are a handful of verses in the Old Testament that try to give us, that we sort of use as a way to get precise dating. Most things are dated relative to other things. And also it seems that the interest in precision is not foremost in the minds of the authors of the Old Testament. I am confident that there is a way that 70 years works out. I'm confident that when this receipt was given, that people weren't being fleeced by the numbers and totals. Unfortunately, as far as we are away from it in history, and because numbers just, there is no external data to numbers to let you know, well, you copied that wrong. If you write 400 instead of 4,000, there's no other clues except for just looking at the receipt again to tell you that that's the right number. So I am confident that in the original text, in the original receipt and, the original edition, the first sort of edition of Ezra's book, that these numbers were accurate, even if they aren't accurate now. People will try to do certain kinds of things where they do all sorts of numerological equations and things. And I'm not sure that that's the point of what's going on here. Anyway, we are told that Sheshbazar faithfully brings these articles with the exiles up from Babylon to Jerusalem. Okay, paragraph 4. So chapter 2, we're going to do in these two paragraphs, because most of chapter 2 is worse than the Begats in Chronicles. It's just a list of a bunch of names of people who we don't know who they are. We have some etymological speculations about what their names mean, and perhaps those are significant. But I am going to skip that for now. The list of the returning exiles are repeated in Nehemiah 7, and people will compare those two things. probably it is interesting for linguists to sort of understand how names shift in different languages or over time or something like that. But I'm going to skip that because if there is significance to that list, I have not done enough research, and there is so much written on this chapter, and most of it seems useless to me. So it may be the case that I will come back to it over the next couple of weeks and realize that there's something significant to say about the names in chapter two that are mostly omitted from this section. I do want to note, let me just read these two paragraphs. Now, these are the people of the province who came up out of the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away to Babylon and returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city. These came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sariah, Reliah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mizpar, Bigvai, Rechum, and Bana. We don't know who any of these people are, except for Zerubbabel and Jeshua. I will talk about those in a second. Now, you may have heard the name Nehemiah before and the name Mordecai before. Some people have speculated that Nehemiah in this list is the Nehemiah of the later chapters of Ezra Nehemiah, the section that we generally refer to as Nehemiah, and that this was an anachronism and the text didn't know what they were talking about and they just forgot. And that seems utterly incredible to me. Nehemiah seems like it could have been a common name. And the same thing is true of Mordecai. As far as we can tell, this is not Esther's cousin Mordecai. This is just another guy with the name Mordecai. And both Nehemiah and Mordecai, along with these other folks who are listed, are these heads of the father's households, right? These are sort of the leaders of the various groups. The two figures who are going to be significant as we move forward are Zerubbabel and Jeshua. Zerubbabel is the kingly heir. He's the Davidic heir, so he would be king. And Jeshua is the Zadokian heir. His line is through Zadok, who during the time of Solomon is picked to be sort of a further sort of correct line for the high priesthood. It had been Aaron, but at some point it gets split and Zadok is the correct, I believe the other brother of Zadok goes off and supports the northern kingdom. And so they get cut off from the legitimate high priesthood. So Jeshua would be high priest. So we have the would-be king and the would-be high priest, except there's not a temple and there's not a throne at the moment. But those are the guys who are going to be in those roles if those institutions are restored. And all these people, it says, now the priests and the Levites, some of the people, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants lived in their cities, and all Israel in their cities. So we're establishing a status quo. Everybody moves back with all of these people. We get a bunch of names of people who move back with them, and they settle back into the cities where they belonged. And this is recalling us to things like Joshua, where the people get established and they have sort of their patch of ground that is theirs, and you know that's part of their families, and they get to live in that part of Israel, and all of them are living in their cities. Okay. I'm looking at the time. I will continue. I doubt we'll get through all of that I was intending to get through today. Okay. So if you're following along in the handout, you will notice that I have made part of chapter 3, verses 1 through 7 in bold. And then I have put the rest in parentheses, and it's not bold. I put it in parentheses and then didn't put it in bold, and it wasn't obvious that you should sort of read the bold parts to, you know, the sections that aren't in parentheses together. So I put it in bold just to extra emphasize that I think those are supposed to be read together. And then there's a very long parenthetical statement in the middle of that section. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the bold part as if it were all one paragraph. And then I will go back and read the parenthetical section. So if you're following along in a regular Bible, this starts in chapter 3, verse 1. Now when the seventh month came and the sons of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. Then Jeshua, the son of Josadak, and his brothers the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brothers arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Then they gave money to the masons and carpenters, and food, drink, and oil to the Sidonians and to the Tyrians, to bring cedar wood from Lebanon to the Sea of Joppa, according to the grant they had from Cyrus, king of Persia. Okay. So, this paragraph is telling us that Jeshua and Zerubbabel, who we noted were the high priest, or the guy who will be high priest, and Zerubbabel, who will be king, or would be king, they get together and they build the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So they start by beginning to offer offerings. And then they don't have the necessary materials that they would need to build the temple. So they put together some trade. They take the money that they had received from their neighbors. And it says, according to the generally... English translations will render this permission, but I think it makes sense to, it's more than a permission, it's a grant. It's actually a grant of money that Cyrus, you know, there's verbiage in Cyrus's proclamation that people should be receiving money. So they're taking that money and they are trading with Sidonians and the Tyrians to get cedar wood from Lebanon. Now this is significant. Well, it might not be significant. It may be that Lebanon is the only place to get cedar wood. However, Lebanon is the place that Solomon got cedar wood when he was building the first temple. So they build the altar so that they are able to offer burnt offerings as Moses commanded, and then they do whatever trade is necessary in order to build the temple. Okay, so here is the parenthetical that is in the middle, and this is related to the building of the altar. So they set up the altar on its foundation, although they were terrified because of the peoples of the lands, and they offered burnt offerings on it to Yahweh, burnt offerings morning and evening. They celebrated the Feast of Booths, that's also Sukkot, as it is written, and offered the fixed number of burnt offerings daily according to the ordinance as each day required. And afterward, there was a continual burnt offering also for the new moons and for all the fixed festivals of Yahweh that were consecrated and from everyone who offered free will offering to Yahweh. From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to Yahweh, but the foundation of the temple of Yahweh had not been laid. Okay. So, it notes that they, even though they were terrified because of the peoples of the lands, the people who were surrounding them, we find later that there's some animosity towards what they're doing. They set up this altar. They offer burnt offerings to Yahweh. One of the most, they offer their ritual offerings are supposed to offer morning and evening. But most significantly, they celebrate the Feast of Booths. Now, the Feast of Booths is a very complicated setup for how you're supposed to offer offerings. You're supposed to offer 13 bulls on the first day and then 12 bulls and so on. Until you get to, I think it's 8. And if you add all those up, it's 70 bulls total. And there's a certain number of lambs you have to offer and a certain number of rams you have to offer and a certain number of, there's a certain amount of flour that has to go and oil and all of that. It's very complicated. And so they're just saying they did it according to the, as it is written, the fixed number of burnt offerings according to the ordinance as each day required. So there's very specific instructions for how to do that, and they do that. And then it notes, but also they were offering continually. They had the new moon and the fixed festivals, and they were using the altar for that. And in fact, they were offering from the first day of the month, even though the foundation hadn't been laid. So this is a very complicated parenthetical. They start offering on the first day of the month, and they're doing everything correctly, but it seems that the main thing that they want to do in setting up this altar is to celebrate the Feast of Booths, and they do it correctly. Okay, I think I will stop there, and we will pick up where we left off next week. Noah asks, how do we know that the prophecy Ezra is referring to is the 70-year prophecy? Could it be another of Jeremiah's prophecies? I am open to that possibility. The reason why I think the prophecy is the 70 years prophecy is if the right way to read the 70 years is when the vessels get returned, then it would be significant that this section sort of ends with the detail that those were returned. I'm open to hearing other suggestions. I'm not sure what we would do with the section of why it includes the fact that they're returning the vessels to Jerusalem. I suppose it would just be illustrating that God is being faithful in some way. But I think that's the main pointer is you're looking at how do we count the 70 years. I think that people, there are different theories of how to count the 70 years, and where do you start. And I think other scholars will do their counting in different ways. And so you're sort of, there are, I have not encountered a commentary that does not assume that the 70 years is what this verse is referring to. It is a little bit odd that they think that that's the case if they don't think the vessels returning is the 70 years thing. But if there's some other prophecy of Jeremiah that would seem to fit better, then I'm up for hearing that. Any other questions? All right. Thank you all for your attention, and hope this is helpful and clarifying. And we will return to Ezra Nehemiah next week.